Morning, everyone, to the final day of IMFA 2015. I hope you've had a good conference. I think it's been a wonderful meeting so far. And it's my great pleasure to introduce one of our platinum sponsors, Autism Speaks, and Rob Ring, who is with us today to tell us about some of their latest initiatives. Thank you.
Thank you, Frankie. All right, so we're in the final stretch, and it has been a great meeting. I certainly want to just start off by congratulating the organizers, the program committees, all the committees that have had a hand behind the scenes in putting together the meeting. One of the best conferences so far, and it's really a great pleasure not only to see a lot of familiar faces, but to see a lot of new faces. In fact, you know, one of the reasons why we at Autism Speaks are so happy to sponsor and provide support for a meeting like this is to see new individuals be pulled into this field. I think this is a very powerful aspect of the meeting that we really appreciate. I'm going to just take a few moments to introduce to those of you who are not familiar with our foundation a little bit about what we do and sort of reinforce among those who have been with us on our journey for the last 10 years. We're celebrating our 10th anniversary this year. Reinforce some of the things we're doing and also alert you to some new changes that are happening and some new initiatives that are really exciting. We're happy to talk about. We are a science and advocacy foundation. We also do an incredible amount of work in the area of awareness, and we have an ever-expanding program in the area of family services, but you know, science has really been at the core of our journey over the last 10 years. We've invested over $280 million into research and all of the sort of allied activities that make up what is now a very robust, very lively research ecosystem. Just using MFAR as a barometer to see how things have changed over the last few years, it's really incredible to watch. And as a foundation, we've been working to support work in a variety of different areas. These are shown up here. These are our core portfolio areas. Many of them are quite familiar to you. The innovative technology area is one of our newest portfolios, if you will. And loosely mapped onto this organigram, if you will, of our program work are some of the sort of key assets, if you will, of the organization, the crown jewels of the programs that we've spent many years nurturing, that over many years many of you have been directly involved in programs such as the Autism Treatment Network, the Baby SIBS Research Consortium, AGREE. All of these have been, I think, real engines of value creation, if you will, for the larger research activities out there. And I think no one's going to disagree with me that really in the DNA of this research ecosystem, this autism research community, is this collaborative spirit, this dependency on partnership across very different disciplines, very different domains of expertise. And I'm really proud to say, you know, mapped onto this, it really some great examples of the partnerships and collaborations that we've depended on, we've cherished over the years, that have helped us be successful, and these draw from both the private and public sectors. They involve lots of partnership with the Department of Health and Human Services, especially the NIH and the various institutes that carry portfolios in the autism space. But As the field continues to progress, we've seen a lot more strategic partnership in the corporate areas as well. Just would like to make a point that although we focused a lot of our support in North America, we do have a very large global footprint. We're funding research, we have advocacy activities, we've got lots of leadership work throughout the globe. And it's a great nod to Andy Shi's leadership, as has been referenced numerous times here at this meeting, that this global front line of autism has continued to expand. So we're very, very proud of that. Would be amiss if I didn't point everyone towards information on our funding opportunities. I'm just offering a few up here. Lots of excitement about our fellowship programs. This is an area we'd like to continue expanding. If you do have questions, want to learn more about all of the funding opportunities we have available, I would really encourage you to visit our booths just outside the ballroom here. We've got a fantastic staff that are very happy to help guide you to additional information and resources on that. We also have a webpage that many of you may have already visited for that information. I'd also just like to point to the fact that beyond the direct funding of research, it's our mission that helps keep the lights on, if you will, for the larger field. You know, we spend an extraordinary amount of time and energy in Washington and in state capitals around the United States and globally pushing the agenda of autism research, trying to increase funding and support in different ways for what you are doing. And you know, I'm really happy that since the last MFAR, where we had a great proclamation from President Obama that we were able to display, since then Congress has passed the Autism CARES Act, which was signed just last year in August. And the significance of this may be not fully understood by everyone, but this essentially makes available $1.3 billion of new funding over the next 5 years. 950 million of that is earmarked to NIH, so $190 million per year for the next 5 years going into many of your projects is indirectly the result of the voices that we and other foundations channel to our lawmakers and in Congress. And I'd say, you know, a significant amount of our time as a staff is spent in the offices of congressmen and women, their staffs, trying to teach them about what you're doing, what the significance and impact of your work is, and where the future is heading in this direction, getting them excited. And I think we can all celebrate that this has been a very successful effort. Beyond our traditional investigator-initiated funding, we've also recently launched a venture arm called Delcia, and this is really helping us be more engaged in the private, you know, for-profit world of helping entrepreneurs and small companies take the discoveries and the innovations that are being showcased in the posters and podium presentations at this meeting and move them forward to the community, to the market. And we're super excited about how this continues to evolve, and there's a booth outside if you want to learn more about that. We have a fantastic core leadership team at Autism Speaks. They're shown here, in some cases, in their office, which is sometimes not a lab, but on TV and in other areas to help advocate and improve awareness of what we're doing. They're around. I encourage you to introduce yourself if you don't know them. We have recently, in the last 2 weeks, had our board chair, Bob Wright, step down from his leadership over the last 10 years. We have a new chairman, and with that comes a really exciting opportunity to do some more strategic planning about the future. And we're really excited to have brought in a new science advisory board in the last year, who are going to be great partners with us as we start to move forward. Just two quick announcements I'd like before I hand it back over to is it Jackie, I think, or Frankie. So. Two quick announcements. For those of you initiatives that are worth taking a look at or tracking as we move forward, many of you might have already heard about this project called Missing. It has a lot of awareness, and I just want to take a moment to explain it. This is a project that we actually started probably over 10 years ago when we first started collecting samples and phenotyping families as part of the AGREE program. And I think many of you have been, you know, amazed to see how quickly genetic technologies have advanced. What took the Human Genome Project over 10 years and $3.5 billion, more human man hours than it took to put a man on the moon, to sequence every letter of code of that first genome, we can now do that for a little over $1,000 in a couple of days' work. It's simply incredible, the ability to generate information about genetics. And we've worked to leverage our work with AGREE and are starting to partner with other researchers to build an unprecedented database of genomic information. We will, by the first quarter of next year, sequence the whole genomes of 10,000 individuals, and we will make that available as an open access resource through the Google Cloud. We're partnering with Google. There's simply no way you can actually work with this scale of data without having a partner like Google. And I'm really excited to announce that we will be launching our portal this summer, which will provide that web interface, that access to the data and all the tools necessary to analyze it, whether or not you're an inexperienced geneticist or you're a super user, if you will. So look out for that this summer. The last thing I wanted to share, and it's really, you know, it's a great credit to my partners across the organization. We're doing really fantastic things across the community. We're just announced this week. You might have seen the Good Morning America crew running around taking video here at the meeting just the other day. But we have partnered with RANGAM Associates to help create a jobs portal for individuals with autism. Think of this as really a monster.com or a careerbuilder.com for individuals with autism, helping employers connect their employment opportunities with individuals who are seeking that employment. We're super excited for that. It's free to all users. And if you want to learn more, please visit thespectrumcareers.com. With that said, I'll make way for our illustrious speaker this morning. And again, thank you guys for being here. And it's a real honor to help support this meeting. Thank you.
Thank you, Rob, and thank you so much for all that you do for the autism research community and for people with autism. I'll now hand over to Jacqueline Crawley, our scientific program co-chair, to introduce this morning's keynote speaker.
It's a great pleasure and an honor to introduce Jeremy Veenstra-Vanderweel from Columbia University, who's the director of the Developmental Neurogenetics Program at the Sackler Institute of Developmental Psychobiology and the Mortimer D. Sackler Associate Professor in the Department of Psychiatry with appointments in pediatrics and pharmacology and the New York State Psychiatric Institute. So that long list is an example of Jeremy's many talents. He is the quintessential physician scientist, the epitome of the bench-to-bedside researcher. So Jeremy got his undergraduate degree at Harvard in psychology and then went to medical school at the University of Chicago, where he went ahead and joined the laboratory of Ed Cook and learned about human genetics while he was a medical student. He then continued his training in child and adolescent psychiatry and went on to Vanderbilt University, where he did a fellowship with Randy Blakely, working on molecular genetics and molecular pharmacology. At the same time, he began to work with mouse models of autism and published some beautiful papers on an integrin B knockout mouse with GABA deficits and a serotonin transporter knockout mouse, and including behavioral phenotyping and neurochemical findings. And so he's really spanned the entire field of research, as well as having clinical practice and getting now into leading drug treatment trials. So he's he's got tons of publications. He's on a long list of advisory panels and review panels and has been the principal investigator in the Novartis and Seaside Therapeutics clinical trials for treatments for Fragile X and for autism. And so at this point, he's very well versed in the excitement of developing medical treatments for autism and the challenges to the field that lie ahead, which will be the subject of his talk this morning. Welcome, Jeremy.
Thank you, Jackie. I'm now going to make an awkward transition over to the Mac. Take me just a moment. It's always humbling to hear these introductions, and it's particularly humbling to be the third in a series that included Dr. Grinker and Dr. Rogers. I found those talks both really quite inspiring. It's also always a little bit interesting to hear one's pedigree and recognize all the happy accidents that that happened along the way. Is that coming up? Yes. No. Thanks. So one of those happy accidents was that I, when I was 19 or 20 years old, wandered around the University of Chicago campus trying to find a summer job, not being a University of Chicago student, and essentially got no help from almost anyone and finally wandered into the child psychiatry office, which probably doesn't happen very often that a 20-year-old who looks like he's about 14, I realize I still look young, but who looked like I was about 14, wanders in and says, you know, do you have a list of the research happening in the department? And I got a list of the research, and Kathy Lord was working on polishing the ADOS at the time. She actually, once I managed to get a job in the division, was the first person I really saw do an assessment of a child with autism, having no idea that this is really one of the people who's revolutionizing assessment. And then had the opportunity to sit in with Ed Cook and Bennett Leventhal, and one of the first patients I saw with Ed Cook turned out to be a girl who helped him identify chromosome 15 Q11 to Q13 duplications specifically from the maternal side as one of the early rare contributors to autism spectrum disorder. And this is essentially by accident. I would have been perfectly happy walking into a lab studying anxiety. I needed a summer job. But it was sort of primed perhaps by growing up knowing that my dad's best friend's son had autism spectrum disorder. When it was first explained to me, I thought it didn't make sense that artistic meant that he was somebody who didn't want to spend any time with me when we came over. And it took quite a while to get a sense of who he was. And I still get to see him once or twice a year. And it's inspiring to see sort of how he's developed, maybe in the same way that our field has been able to see the inspiration of people like Donald, who was the first person diagnosed with autism, at least using those words. Manny DiCicco Bloom just told me I had to explain all of autism in 37 minutes. At which point I guess I do a mic drop and walk off. But I don't plan to do that. I plan to instead talk about what I see as one of the real tensions as we move forward as a field. A tension between what we're discovering on the genetic side and then what we've been learning from the top in studying in many different ways people with autism spectrum disorder compared to control populations most typically. And then how those two approaches might lead us toward new treatments. I'll do my best. I probably will succeed in articulating the tension. I don't know that we're at the point where we know for sure how these new treatments are going to emerge, but hopefully these pathways do lead us forward. As Jackie mentioned in her generous introduction, I do have some conflicts of interest. I'll highlight these when they come up. I've consulted with and had research funding from a number of pharmaceutical companies. None of that has yet led to a drug that's come to market, which is disappointing, but that means the conflicts are maybe a little less relevant than they might otherwise be. The other disclosure is these are folks who've worked with me, and so it's important to highlight that this isn't work that's done necessarily just with my hands. It's not work that comes out of just my lab. In fact, I'm really going to do a broad overview and not focus that much on stuff from my lab, so I want to acknowledge that up front. And finally, the other disclosure is I can't possibly talk about all of the treatments in development. I'm really limiting myself to medical treatments, but the first two columns are just things that are being talked about or presented about at this conference, and then those other two columns are about 20 of the first 600 or so things that are currently registered at clinicaltrials.gov. So there's a lot of active work in this area. It's hard to say what of that is going to lead us forward, so I'm going to give some examples, but certainly can't be comprehensive. So I'm going to start by doing a fairly brief overview of the challenge of heterogeneity in autism, which really corresponds to the challenge as we think about precision medicine. Then talk about what we currently know. Again, that will be quite brief. And then move forward to three different pathways forward, really two and then one that maybe is an in-between pathway. I think it's important as I talk about this that I don't give you the impression that we're going to have medicines that by themselves lead to something that would be described as a cure. That would be lovely, but what I imagine instead is that at best we are going to be able to put the brain in a state to better benefit from behavioral treatments, put the brain in a state to learn, and then teach. And I think that's what we really need to aspire to. I think as Sally Rogers really beautifully articulated yesterday, we already have a lot of knowledge about what sort of behavioral interventions lead to benefit. And I think what we're looking for is medicines that can help children who may not benefit as much and help the larger group of children benefit more. So the challenge of heterogeneity can be thought of in a lot of different ways. This is one way that I think about it. And when I see a kid clinically, I'm reminded of this over and over again. I do certainly have kids that I see who resonate in my mind with other kids. You think, oh, this child reminds me of so-and-so. But I've yet to have a child walk into the office who only has autism spectrum disorder. They always present with something more complicated than that. And even if they did just present with autism spectrum disorder, as we were reminded eloquently by Dr. Grinker, that isn't really a thing, right? It's our way of describing something that we don't fully understand. With more knowledge, we'll be able to sort that out better. But most kids walk in with some difficulty with cognition, some difficulty with language. Not all. Some kids are really adept there. Many, many children walk in with some sort of co-occurring behavioral challenge, be it anxiety, be it hyperactivity, be it agitation and aggression that may sometimes be the real reason that they're coming in to see me. Many children come in with co-occurring medical problems, and that that's usually the first thing that we want to address. So if a child has a seizure disorder, you want to address that. If a child has severe constipation that's making them uncomfortable, you want to address that. And then increasingly, children are coming in with these genetic findings that by and large we don't know what to do with yet. Families ask, you know, have you treated a child with this before? Do you know how to deal with a child with this? And the truth is, we as a field by and large don't, right? But we're hoping to, and that's, I think, where the promise of precision medicine is. And then we have lots of things that have been identified as potential biomarkers by years and years of research, from neuroimaging to EEG, ERP work, to peripheral biochemistry, many different possibilities of things that could guide us toward a precision medicine. But thus far, none of that really has an indication on the clinical side. None of it has yet delivered a test that we run in order to decide how to treat a child. When we do a treatment study, we take a child who may fit this pattern, and this pattern might fit Fragile X syndrome or maybe tuberous sclerosis. And here's my opportunity to give a plug. After this, there will be a panel focused on the pathways forward in precision medicine that have really gone the furthest, including a number of these syndromes. And then maybe a child who fits this pattern, and I'll use this example later in the talk as well, where there's a particular biomarker and maybe a medical profile that corresponds to it to a limited degree. We put this one and 100 others together, and we test a treatment for autism spectrum disorder. We all know that isn't what's the most logical thing to do, but it's what we're limited with at the moment. And I think we have to acknowledge that limitation, and I think that's one of our big challenges. If we take that heterogeneity and just think about it on the genetic side, we still have a model that's supported by data from large samples that suggest that multiple common risk factors, including genetic variants, but also including environmental exposures, likely contribute to autism in a large population, but probably not in every child. What's been much more apparent is that there are relatively rare exposures, largely genetic, that by themselves contribute the majority of risk for an individual. And that includes Fragile X syndrome as the most common of these, which will be one of the examples, chromosome 16p11 deletion syndrome, another example, tuberous sclerosis, P10 hamartoma syndrome, Phelan-McDermid syndrome, CHD8 mutations, and on and on and on, which is wonderful, very exciting. But you'll note none of these account for more than 1 or 2% by themselves, and most of them are well under those numbers, a real challenge when we think about treatment development. And then we have some environmental clues as well. So exposure to valproate during pregnancy clearly leads to a significant increase in risk of autism spectrum disorder, as well as a number of other co-occurring medical conditions. So we have these clues, and what we hope for is that we'll have some of these that coalesce. And for folks that stick around for the panel, you'll hear about one of these, developments in tuberous sclerosis, that may apply to a larger group of kids who have disruption in mTOR signaling. that leads to disinhibition. And what we'd like, really, is if that then gives us a clue about the larger population, that there may be common variants in those same pathways. But that remains an unknown. So that risk, then, at the genetic level, is actually sort of the most simple part of the equation. As you walk forward, you get to sort of order of magnitude increases in complexity. So from genes to protein networks, somewhere in here lies development. It's unclear exactly where you plug that in, but that's clearly important. Cells, synapses, brain regions, brain circuits. And then we expect that we see some coalescence again at the point of symptoms, at the point of behavior. So that one gene variant may lead forward something like this, where you're affecting different brain regions, different pathways. Another may look something like this. Another may look something like this. And this is, of course, our best case scenario, where you actually get coalescence at the level of circuits that connect to behaviors, and you're then potentially able to develop a treatment there. Most of what we do when we compare the autism population to the control population is sort of at that level. Best case, moving from symptoms to circuits, and hoping that we have things that are in common at that level without really knowing what lies underneath, a fairly substantial black box. We also could have coalescence much further down, so at the point of protein networks, where at that point you don't necessarily know where the lines are leading forward, or maybe at the point of development. And there's really elegant work coming out from Matt State's group and others, really pointing to particular points in development that may matter quite a lot. But there, too, we've got a big black box, right? So then we don't necessarily know what lies between that and the symptoms that lead to the diagnosis. So these are some of the challenges. Another challenge is, quite unfortunately, we have what Huda Zoghbi and others have termed the Goldilocks problem. And this is that if you have a developmental risk gene that's disrupted in some individuals, at this point we know that you'd be very wise to look for an increase in expression of the same gene. So this has been shown for MECP2. This has been shown for maternal chromosome 15q deletions, duplications, 16p11 deletions, duplications, the Williams syndrome region, and on, to the point that if you identify a disruption, you should look for something that might lead to an enhancement of the same pathway. That's a substantial challenge, because if we have a treatment that leads this individual to improve, we obviously would lead this individual to get much worse. And that's really not what we want to do, and that would be very hard if we had a large population of individuals with autism to detect something that was leading to benefit in some and not in the overall group. And that may lead to something that looks maybe more like this circle, where maybe you've got symptoms in the middle, but you have many, many different ways to get there. You may still have coalescence. You may still have ways to develop a targeted treatment, but you're going to need to know a lot about the individual before you apply the treatment. So that's the challenge. It feels like bad news, but the truth is, we didn't have any of these clues before. And as we get these clues, we do have pathways forward. They're not simple, but who really expected autism spectrum disorder to be simple in the first place? We're getting a sense of where that complexity comes from, and that raises challenges but also opportunities. So I want to pause for a moment before we plunge forward into talking about precision medicines to talking about what we really know right now. And I should acknowledge that this work comes out of largely efforts from the Vanderbilt Evidence-Based Practice Center, including efforts from Zach Warren here in the audience, Melissa McFeeters, and others. It's really an assessment of evidence, not of how well something works, right? So it's based on how much we know, not how powerful a treatment is. On the behavioral side, I have one slide. And this is where most children with autism spectrum disorder should be spending most of their time. It's where I'm spending the least time. I hope you listen to me saying that it's important, and I hope that you attended Sally Rogers' talk yesterday. So as I think Sally very eloquently convinced us all, early intensive behavioral interventions are effective for many children and are important. This is really what we should be doing. There are still things that are unknown, which children benefit the most, which particular approaches, which components of the approaches are most effective, but clearly this is where we need to be spending our clinical dollars. Right? We have some evidence of behavioral interventions later on. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that, but I think it's incredibly important. So then I'm going to turn to medications, and that's really sort of the focus of this thinking about biologically based interventions. I think it's unfortunately helpful to think about where we have the most knowledge, and actually the medicine that's been best studied in autism spectrum disorder is a medicine that provides no benefit whatsoever, Secretin. And this is important because it tells us two things. First, that we are prone to believing things early as a field, and that when we don't have better treatments, people oftentimes turn to things without a lot of evidence, based on hope. And that early case studies and reports in the general population can lead to a sense of buzz and excitement around a treatment that then, when you have multiple randomized controlled trials, turns out to do nothing. So that's one lesson. The other is the placebo effect is incredibly effective, or has an incredibly large impact in autism spectrum disorder, particularly when you're looking at development. So children with autism don't stop developing, right? They may be developing on a different trajectory, and so it's very difficult to detect changes in rate of development or improvement in things like language when you have an intervention that carries with it a large placebo effect. You want to see improvement, and children do make improvements, even if it isn't at the rate that you might hope for, and even if your medicine isn't making an impact. So where we have evidence for benefit is not for autism spectrum disorder. It's for a particular group of symptoms that's been termed irritability, but really corresponds to irritability, agitation, distress that leads to aggression, self-injury behaviors. And in that domain, risperidone and aripiprazole have considerable evidence, but they do the same thing that they would do in me. If I had taken one of these before this talk, I'd be less nervous, I might be asleep. They are calming. This class was originally called major tranquilizers. They carry with them major side effects, and there's no evidence that they benefit core symptoms, except to allow a child to benefit from the behavioral intervention by staying in a classroom because they're no longer so agitated, or staying at home because they can be cared for at home. All other medicines have considerably less evidence, except for those medicines that are really used to treat ADHD symptoms. With the DSM-5, we can diagnose ADHD in the context of autism. It's not surprising these medicines work for those symptoms. They work less well in the ASD population and lead to more side effects. And then there's mixed evidence in a lot of other arenas. And I'm not going to spend time talking about the serotonin reuptake inhibitors, except to say that it may be illustrative of a pattern we need to watch out for, which is that in children, these medicines are very difficult to tolerate. And in most studies, you see significant side effects with some hints of benefit in a subpopulation. And yet in adults, these medicines seem to lead to significant benefit, which points to different effects at different developmental stages, which is clearly going to matter when we think about treatment development. So that takes us to pathways toward new treatments. Obviously not spending a whole lot of time on existing treatments because we don't have much evidence in the medical arena. So where we have, I think, the most excitement is the development of precision medicines. And this is going to be the focus of the panel happening right after this. I'm going to use one or two examples, but please do come to the panel and hear about more detail, because I'm going to sort of present a cartoon of what's happening right now. So there are a number of these rare genetic syndromes that include ASD, not always in the majority of children, but in a significant minority. So you can think of them as major risk factors. The one I'm going to spend the most time on is Fragile X syndrome, and this is one of the genetic tests that's really indicated clinically right now for every child with a neurodevelopmental disorder, particularly children with autism spectrum disorder who have some degree of intellectual impairment. So Fragile X syndrome is X-linked recessive. It is, by definition, associated with mild to moderate intellectual disability, usually moderate intellectual disability, but typically includes some degree of social impairment, from social anxiety to a frank diagnosis of autistic disorder by DSM-4. We don't frankly know what DSM-5 rates of ASD would be in this population, but it's probably about half. Okay? These kids also have other behavioral features like hyperactivity and impulsivity, sensory sensitivity. Oftentimes they have an increased risk of seizures, still a minority of the population. They have a characteristic appearance that to me doesn't look so characteristic. They have prominent ears, prominent jaw, prominent forehead. They look like a family member of mine. This is now more or less established science that I'm going to go through quite quickly. So the gene for Fragile X syndrome was identified back in the early 1990s. It's FMR1, named for Fragile X mental retardation 1. The defect that occurs in Fragile X syndrome is based on an expansion of a trinucleotide repeat. This part of it I'm not expecting you to remember all of, but it leads to silencing of gene expression. And the corresponding gene actually, the corresponding protein interacts with many, many different mRNAs. It's an mRNA chaperone, so it has pretty profound effects in terms of downstream genes that it can impact. The story that's emerged that at this point is really the dominant hypothesis about why Fragile X leads to intellectual disability, and perhaps maybe that why that extends to autism spectrum disorder, has to do with one particular role that fMRP has. And that's at the glutamatergic synapse. So if this is the presynaptic neuron, and this is the postsynaptic neuron, glutamate signals, and we typically think about receptors like the AMPA receptor more or less as the gas of the synapse. This is where the signaling happens, but there's another receptor, mGluR5, that you might think of as the brake in the system. So you need both gas and brake in order to function adequately, but because we don't have a little driver at the synapse, you also have to have things like fMRP that actually acts like a release on the brake of mGluR5 signaling. When you don't have that, what you get is too much internalization of that AMPA receptor, which leads to something called long-term depression. And in the case of long-term depression, you fail to get mature synapses. And I recognize that this is a cartoon. It's so that everybody is sort of on the same page as we're thinking about how this moves forward into treatment. When you have excessive long-term depression, inadequate formation of mature synapses, you then have as a consequence a failure to suppress nearby dendritic spines. So these are the sort of antennae of the neuron reaching out to make connections with nearby neurons, receiving the signal from the presynaptic side. And that has an anatomic readout. And what's really striking is that in the mouse model of Fragile X syndrome, lacking that same gene, you see a neuropathology at the level of dendritic spines that is almost indistinguishable from what's been published in the neuropathology of humans with Fragile X syndrome. You see an increase in dendritic spines, you see that they're too long, you see that they have an immature appearance in contrast with either the control mouse or the quote-unquote control human. These mice also have behavioral phenotypes, so they have what is a fairly mild increase in hyperactivity. They have extremely subtle social deficits that have been difficult to replicate from lab to lab. They have changes in learning that have been similarly very difficult to replicate from lab to lab. And they have a robust inducible seizure phenotype. So they don't necessarily capture the behavioral profile, even though they clearly capture something about what's happening in the brain. And that's a real challenge when we think about developing an outcome measure that is going to reflect what we see in the mouse, right? From what's seen in the mouse, it's really hard to say what's our right outcome for human studies, maybe hyperactivity. To demonstrate that this hypothesis holds true, Mark Baer's lab, which has really done a lot of this work, did something that you'd really only do in an animal model, which is that they cut in half the amount of mGluR5 receptor that's expressed in the animal. That should cut in half this downstream signaling, acting to balance out the fact that fMRP is not present, and should lead to more of the AMPA receptor back at the cell surface, and in theory at least, reverse these deficits that are seen. And that's exactly what they saw in this mouse model. And this is now 7 years ago, so there's been a lot of progress since then. But I'll just briefly show you the wild-type animal in appearance, the null animal in appearance, the animal that's lacking the Fragile X gene, and then the animal that both has an absence of the Fragile X gene and has half the normal expression of this receptor. So this is exactly the sort of thing that you'd like to carry forward into a treatment, and yet it doesn't take us all the way to behavior. So if we think about this cascade, we know we're at the point of synapses. We don't necessarily know brain region. We don't necessarily know circuits. And we don't necessarily know how that connects directly to behavior. But this is as far as we've gotten with precision medicines. And this is really exciting. This is the sort of thing where you have an intervention, and then you look for what seems to be improving in the human, knowing that we can't necessarily predict it from the mouse. The pharmacologic rescue now has been published for a couple of years, and this came from a group at Roche in collaboration with Mark Baer's lab, here depicted differently, but a similar rescue. Importantly, when we're thinking about timing of intervention, these mice were first treated shortly after weaning, and that treatment extended to sexual maturity. So that's 4 weeks in a mouse. Obviously, that's a much longer period of time in a human, and we really have to think about how we can parallel what shows benefit in a mouse in human studies. These mice had a rescue of any number of phenotypes, including behavior, hyperactivity, some improvement in learning, not something that necessarily parallels the task we do in humans, improvement in auditory sensitivity, decrease in seizures, and perhaps most importantly, didn't have any obvious ill effects on health. So, very exciting, but now the question is, what about humans? And I'll say that Liz Berry Kravis is going to talk more about this story in the panel to follow. I'll talk a little bit about it. There were some really exciting early findings in crossover studies in small populations using more exploratory outcome measures to try to look for hints of benefit. Unfortunately, in the two larger studies that followed this up, there really wasn't a significant difference in any outcome measures that have been reported on. Some of that data has been described in posters here this week. And those programs have now been closed down. But those initial studies were in adults and then carried down to adolescents. They don't really parallel the time course that we think about in a mouse. The outcome measures here are really difficult to predict. But in the population that was studied, these are folks who oftentimes are not in the sort of classroom setting where you're going to be able to track learning in the way that you would like to. And there wasn't a defined learning paradigm or cognitive measures that were perhaps as robust as we would like. But this is an open question, and this is the challenge when we think about developing precision medicine. We've never had a medicine that does this. So how do you know how to test it, right? And Liz will talk more about how to do that. I should say there are also a lot of other targets that you can think about in Fragile X syndrome, and Liz is going to talk, I think, about some of these others. I've highlighted them. I'm not going to talk about them individually. Some of them are based on this same hypothesis. Some of them are based on other observations. Fragile X, then, is really the vanguard when we think about clinical description moving to gene identification, moving to animal model, hypothesis about mechanism, and then moving forward to the point that we actually have clinical treatment studies. I think we could get discouraged that the initial treatments didn't work, but I think we have to recognize that it's taken a long time to find behavioral treatments that we can show are effective. It's very difficult to know what outcome measures are going to be most useful. I think that this is going to lead to treatments in the next few years, which is tremendously exciting to think about. But fMRP actually has many other roles, and we're intervening at a higher point in that hierarchy, and maybe that means that we're going to affect a narrower range of symptoms. Maybe we'd be happier with something that intervenes at a lower point, intervenes perhaps more at a molecular cellular level, within an individual cell. And Mustafa Sahin is going to talk about tuberous sclerosis, where you're really intervening at the level of very critical signaling at the cellular level, in mTOR signaling, where if you're lacking the genes implicated in tuberous sclerosis, you get disinhibition of mTOR signaling. That might be more like this level. Before all this branching has happened, before we have the diversity of brain regions and synapses, and before we have the diversity of circuits. But then there's a lot more unknown about what sort of outcome measures we might see as improving. Chronic mTOR inhibition in humans is already being used in tuberous sclerosis to treat tubers, to treat lung growths. And in mice, including in work done by Mustafa Sahin and others, including Craig Powell here working in a parallel system, in animals lacking P10 that have a common cellular pathway deficit. You see improvements in sociability. You see improvements in learning. So this is another area where there's a lot of excitement about moving forward, and there's ongoing trials that Mustafa will talk about looking at cognitive and social endpoints in children who are being treated with mTOR inhibitors in tuberous sclerosis. So those are really the pathways to precision medicine or what that looks like. What I think we might get out of that, first off, is a treatment that actually works. Even if it works in 1% of the ASD population, that would be amazing, right? We would love to see something like that. But then I think we also learn something about how to study treatments that may have an impact on outcome measures we wouldn't otherwise have been thinking about, at what point in development we can expect to move particular symptom domains, at what point we frankly can't. And that's something that we really need to know in order to be able to take treatments like this and study similar things in the broader ASD population. And finally, what we can hope for is that there's some degree of overlap, right? This is like the first genetic slide I showed you, the hope that there is some treatment domain that benefits in the larger population, maybe a subset of that larger population based on a common system or pathway. So that's really the precision medicine approach. The other approach doesn't necessarily posit that we understand the pathophysiology, but means that we understand something about circuitry. This may be core human circuitry. This may be core primate circuitry. This may be core mammal circuitry. It could go down to Drosophila. It could go down to fruit flies. But that we understand something about circuitry that may not be specific to autism spectrum disorder, but may give us a sense of how to move a particular symptom target. So while precision medicine sounds great and promising, and I'm very excited about it, it isn't really where we've developed treatments in ASD so far. And you could say that this is true and draw parallels on the behavioral side, but when we think about symptomatic treatments on the medical side, oftentimes one of the first things I do when I see a child with autism spectrum disorder is clearly not specific to ASD, but it's to relieve their constipation, make them more comfortable, right? If you can treat epilepsy, you can improve learning and social function in a child with autism spectrum disorder because you can get rid of the seizures that are interfering. If you can treat some of the co-occurring behavioral challenges, from anxiety to irritability and agitation to ADHD symptoms to tics or stereotypy, similarly, you can lead to significant improvement. But I don't think we would claim that any of these treatments are specific to the pathophysiology of ASD. And maybe more controversially, not every child with ASD has a defect in quote-unquote sociability. Many folks with ASD actually prefer the company of another human to the company of an object, which is what we commonly measure in our behavioral testing in mice. But many people in ASD would prefer to be around family or would prefer to be around a stranger, but have difficulty negotiating that interaction. And so if we have a treatment that benefits sociability, that's probably going to benefit a subset of individuals with autism. But it may make life more difficult for others who are now even more driven to spend time with people and still have difficulty negotiating that social interaction. So that would be something I'd be thrilled to move, but I don't think it necessarily means we're addressing core pathophysiology, at least in the overall group of folks with autism. And I would assert that the treatments that benefit the majority of children with ASD, so if we have something that, say, leads to benefit in 80% of the ASD population, are likely not going to be based on a true understanding of pathophysiology in that 80%. They're much more likely to be based on an understanding of underlying circuitry, and they may lead to improvement in a particular symptom domain, but may not lead to the sort of broad improvement we imagine with precision medicine. This is more or less the RDoC approach that NIMH talks a lot about. Except the RDoC approach is usually built on top of the idea of precision medicine, and I'm not sure that exactly works. But I would say that these treatments are not going to be things that we describe as cures. They're things that we would describe as improving a particular symptom domain, which I would be tremendously excited to see. They're based much more on this idea, that we may understand circuitry that connects to particular symptoms and be able to identify some intervention at this point. But frankly, some of them are likely to look more like this. A big black box. And I should acknowledge as a child psychiatrist that essentially all of the medication treatments that we have to treat behaviors that we identify are based on this approach, right? Everything that we've developed is based on an observation that then is tested and refined over time, but isn't necessarily based on an understanding of pathophysiology. We haven't actually done the precision medicine approach. We don't know how to do it yet. This is an approach, unfortunately, that we know something about. So I'm going to give one example of this. There are many that you can think about. The example I'm going to use is oxytocin. And the reason I'm going to use oxytocin as an example is that this really is something that's emerged from knowledge going all the way back to rodents, where you have an understanding of a naturally occurring hormone that impacts social behavior. And we know that in any number of domains that I'm not going to go through in a lot of detail. But it clearly impacts social behavior, regardless of whether you have a diagnosis relevant to social behavior or not.
It may make you more likely to trust somebody to buy a used car. This could have all sorts of bad uses. But if it does what people hope it does, maybe it could be useful as a treatment, despite the fact that there are really inconsistent findings in the oxytocin system in autism spectrum disorder. I would say right now, the jury's out about whether oxytocin is involved in any way in the pathophysiology of autism. There's some emerging, exciting data, but it certainly isn't something you'd say is universally involved. So, what might this look like in ASD if this is something that works? And I'm going to present a couple of examples. So this is work from Andari et al. Published back in 2010, where they did one-time administration of intranasal oxytocin versus saline in a laboratory setting where individuals felt like they were either throwing a ball, now it was just a computer game, but throwing a computerized ball to somebody who would always throw the ball back, somebody who would throw it willy-nilly, or somebody who would never return it. In the quote-unquote healthy subjects, you see that they prefer to play catch with the person who plays nicely and throws it back. In the ASD population, and this is high-functioning ASD individuals who clearly understand the task, you see initially no preference when they receive intranasal saline vehicle control, whereas when they receive intranasal oxytocin, they show a preference now for throwing the ball to the individual who throws the ball back. Now, why, we don't know, right? So, hard to say. But that's the sort of behavior that people look at in the laboratory, and then we all immediately think, oh my gosh, that could really do something powerful out in the real world setting. And this is another very elegant study from Kevin Pelfrey's group, now published a couple years ago, showing that there are also brain changes in response to intranasal oxytocin, even in this study where there wasn't a change at the level of behavior. And what they showed was that there is an enhancement in a number of brain regions after receiving intranasal oxytocin versus receiving vehicle control in response to seeing faces in contrast to seeing pictures of houses. And here you see that some of this includes lighting up the nucleus accumbens with the idea that it may lead to a change in social reward, a number of other cortical regions that you can point to as involved in social response, social attention. So clearly this is something that's doing something at the level of the brain, something that's doing something at the level of behavior, not always in the same study, and in the laboratory setting with single dose administration. So this is now available on Amazon.com. It's not something that I am advocating that people go out there and use, but I think that this is another one of these situations where we have very promising initial data that we have to be really hesitant to extrapolate too much from. And I'm very hopeful about this, but I certainly don't think we should be treating kids with ASD with this universally. We don't really know what chronic dose administration is going to do. It also, by the way, is available in case your spouse has a wandering eye, and is available also as an anti-wrinkle cream. And this is particularly sobering. It's available as sublingual drops for children who can't tolerate intranasal administration. And this is concerning at any number of levels. This is not what we should be doing. But this is now something that tens of thousands of kids in this country are taking without a real knowledge of how this might work or how this might harm. What we really need is larger sample sizes. We need to move this into the real world. There's one real-world study of moderate size that really didn't show a significant benefit. We need more, we need longer, and we need to have a sense of whether it works by itself, whether it only works with single-dose administration in the laboratory setting, whether it only works when hooked to a social intervention. A lot of unknowns, and then unknowns at the level of outcome measures as well, because we haven't previously had things that do this. We don't know how we'll be able to measure it. And so the disclosure, I'm part of a large study to try to do this initially, not knowing for sure that it is going to be the very right way to implement it, but knowing that we need to quickly test something that's being implemented already in open label fashion in the general population. So that's that approach, but I think we really need something that lies somewhere in between. We'd like an approach that gives us really something that benefits more than 1%, but we need to acknowledge that we're probably not going to get things that benefit the majority of children. And in that context, I'm going to present an example that now I guess we first presented here a couple of years ago. And I'm not saying that this is something that we know works, so this is another thing I don't think people should go out and start implementing. But it shows the pattern of response that we might see and might pose the challenge that we have to resolve in order to test medicines. And this is a study of our baclofen. It's an adequately powered study. It had a number of outcome measures that I'm not going to go through in a lot of detail. It had one outcome measure, clinical global impression of severity, that was right at the level of significance, either depending on how you correct it, p equals 0.054, with correction for how many measures were looked at. The primary outcome measure, which is a measure of lethargy and social withdrawal, did not move at all. So I think it's important to acknowledge that. But when you look at this clinical global impression of severity, you see a move that occurs starting around 8 weeks and extends to 12 weeks. When you zoom in on that, these are ratings that the clinician is making. If you're looking at severity ratings, you're talking about a child who's rated as profoundly severe and moving to moderately severe, or a child who has marked severity and is moving to mild severity. With those changes, you can have a decrease of 1, 2, 3, or 4, or you can end up having no change at all. And you can see that there is some difference here. Importantly, there's another measure, a rating of improvement, that also shows some parallel of children who are rated as not improved. When you zoom in then on those children who show significant movement, and this is the sort of movement we don't see that commonly in the clinic, honestly, a movement of 2, 3, or 4 points on this scale, who also had a similar movement rating of improvement in the same context. You see that there's an advantage of active drug over placebo, but it's really present in 13% of the population. That seems to be what's really driving this. Now, because this isn't how you design a study, you can't conclude, oh, this is something that works in 13% of the population. You need to figure out how to follow this up, how to identify those kids who might improve. And there's some data, and this is all work funded by Seaside Therapeutics, which is no longer a going venture, some data suggesting that a particular clinical profile might predict to some extent who benefits. But what we'd ideally like is a biomarker that says this system is involved in a subset of kids. These are the kids who are likely to benefit. Those are the kids we're going to enroll in a study and see whether or not they truly improve. Ideally, that would be something that can obviously be readily quantified, can be measured reliably, can be replicated easily. The rest is sort of an unknown. Does it need to be heritable? Does it need to be related to autism risk? Does it need to be something that has a clear line where these kids clearly have the biomarker and these kids clearly don't? Does it need to change with treatment? I don't know. We've never had something like this. And then does it actually need to be connected to pathophysiology? And I would say, probably not. The sorts of things that we identify as potential biomarkers have really unclear ties to the actual pathophysiology, at least for the most part. And where that might fit is somewhere between these precision medicine interventions, where you might only be able to treat a very small percentage of children, but might have a fairly profound benefit, and these symptomatic treatments, where you might be able to treat a lot of children, but might have a relatively small amount of benefit. Where somewhere in there, we'd like to have biomarker-based treatments. We have a lot of potential biomarkers. This is always something that draws attention at this meeting. I think one potential is that we have genetic findings that coalesce. So they may coalesce on genes that are actually bound by the Fragile X protein. They may coalesce on genes that are regulated by CHD8, which has a lot of evidence pointing to it. Maybe at the level of neuroimaging, maybe at the level of something that could be measured like head size or body growth during a critical period of time. Very interesting work on that from Kasia Chaworska. It could be something biochemical, something that can be measured in the periphery. It could be something immune. I'm going to use one particular example, in part because it's my own restricted interest, but in part because it's something that's been around for a long time, so we know a lot about the biomarker. And this is elevated blood serotonin levels. This was first described back in 1961 by my great-grand mentor, I never actually met, Daniel X. Friedman. And over time has emerged as something that may have a bimodal distribution or may just have a really long tail that's not seen very much in the general population. So we're talking about more than 25% of kids with ASD who are above the 95th percentile for this particular marker. Interestingly, Suma Jacob actually showed that there's a negative association, negative correlation between blood serotonin levels and plasma oxytocin levels. I don't know that that tells us that this is a biomarker for oxytocin response. I'm just saying that these systems may be tied together, and we should think about how to tie one biomarker to another. The serotonin that's contained in the blood is entirely in platelets. Oh, that's funny, the nucleus showed up. That's what I was seeking to avoid. In any case, platelets don't have nuclei. The serotonin transporter is responsible for taking serotonin up into the platelet as the platelet passes through the enteric circulation. Serotonin levels in the blood are incredibly heritable, more heritable than height. So this is the sort of thing you like to use to map genes. Probably not rare genes, probably common genes. This is something that you see running together in families where a child may have autism, but also running together in the general population. Interestingly, those serotonin levels are actually associated with variation in the serotonin transporter gene, but exclusively in males, not in females. They're also, back when we did linkage, there's a broad linkage peak overlying the serotonin transporter gene, again, only in families with affected males and no affected females. This is work from Jim Sutcliffe's lab. And based on that work, Jim's lab, together with Randy Blakely's lab, looked for rare variants in these families with strong evidence for linkage. They found a number of these rare variants. These rare variants are in parts of the gene that are pretty important for protein function. And each one of them, interestingly, led to an increase in serotonin transport in cell models. So this is the sort of thing that you'd expect would lead to more serotonin being taken up into the platelet, higher serotonin levels in the blood, which wasn't tested in this study directly. The most common of those changes was a change from a glycine to an alanine at a particular point that's important in regulation of the serotonin transporter. It's a very subtle change. This is something that's conserved in mammals, not conserved all the way back to birds. It was overtransmitted to males with autism, but not females with autism, and was specifically associated with rigid compulsive symptoms and with sensory aversion. This is also found in some people who are perfectly healthy, including women in these families, and I think including some men in other populations. So what it really does is it gives us something that may be a risk factor that may relate to hyperserotonemia that we can actually study in an animal. And that's what we did. We put this into a mouse model, straight knock-in, so we're putting just this variant in and a little extra DNA as a marker. This does recapitulate the biomarker, elevated blood serotonin levels. And when we think about this in the brain, we have to recognize that the platelet and the brain don't work exactly the same. So if you have increased serotonin transporter activity in the platelet, you'll see increased serotonin in the platelet and increased serotonin in the blood. At least that's the concept. If you have it in the brain, you would have more serotonin taken up out of the synapse, more serotonin potentially present in the presynaptic neuron depending on regulation. And so to test that, after we sort of struck out doing a number of other approaches, Lynn Dawes' lab used an in vivo approach to show that serotonin that's dumped in actually is cleared more rapidly in mutant animals in comparison to wild-type animals. And then obviously we'd like something that corresponds to a behavioral change that could be relevant to autism. We measured a number of behaviors. I'm going to highlight a couple. One is that these animals showed decreased ultrasonic vocalizations early in life, at postnatal day 7 when separated from their mothers, from the dam. And then they also showed a robust phenotype at the level of the tube test. And this is obviously not a parallel of what we do in the ADOS. But this is a fairly naturalistic way for mice to meet up. The mutant animals tend to back away. Again, I wouldn't say that there's a direct parallel to what we see in autism, but it gives us a readout at the level of social behavior so that we can understand whether a manipulation actually changes social behavior in the animals. Importantly, you don't make a mouse to understand what autism might look like in a mouse. You make a mouse to understand what's happening in the brain, because that's something that we have a hard time assessing in humans, at least at the level of many of the things that we can measure in the mouse. So we've now gone through and shown that there is an increase in sensitivity of serotonin receptors in these animals. I'm not going to go through a lot of detail here. There is actually a change in firing of serotonergic neurons where they fire less commonly or less frequently. Serotonin actually is quite relevant for brain development. And we are particularly interested in sensory development because of the association with sensory aversion in these individuals who had this variant. And so we looked at early sensory development during that period of time when axons are projecting from the thalamus into the sensory cortex, and saw that there's a broader girth of those projections. And interestingly, that is enhanced in the context of a mother who also has the same variant, much more so than in a pup that is in a heterozygous animal, suggesting that there is an interaction between maternal and individual genotype, which is something that Ed Cook's lab has described with the serotonin transporter gene in humans. And of course, I talked earlier about constipation. Maybe I'm preoccupied there too. But the largest source of serotonin is actually not in the brain. It's in the gut. And so we were interested in what might be happening in the gut of these animals and whether that might be something that could point us toward development in the brain, because the gut is a much simpler system. We were also pointed in this direction because our animals actually developed prolapse based on what we thought was significant constipation. Constipation is more common in autism spectrum disorder. It is associated with rigid compulsive behavior. And in work that was presented here by Sarah Marler, there is a small but significant correlation between lower GI symptoms and blood serotonin levels in ASD. And in these animals, Kara Gross in Mike Gershon's lab was able to show that they do indeed have increased intestinal transit time. And interestingly, when they then tried to unpack that, they found that there was a pretty profound difference in development of a number of neuronal subsets in the gut, including development of GABAergic neurons in the gut, where there was a dramatic decrease in these neurons. And we're now looking in the brain, and this is very preliminary. It's like Declan Murphy sometimes puts up a big warning about preliminary data. So we're now looking in the brain to see if we have parallels, and there's some initial sign that there may be a parallel with a decrease in GAD67 staining that we're now trying to understand better. So that's something that sort of grew out of a biomarker and carries us forward, but we're not quite at the point where we know where to intervene. There is some preliminary data in collaboration with Randy Blakely suggesting that if you block the regulatory pathway that leads to increased action at the serotonin transporter, that you can reverse some of these phenotypes. You also imagine you could just block the serotonin transporter itself. Interestingly enough, it's never really been tested whether that is effective in individuals with elevated blood serotonin levels or whether they might be the group that is really sensitive to that sort of intervention. And then ideally, we'd like to find something downstream that we could intervene upon that wouldn't act at the level of cell signaling. There's the question not just where to intervene, but when and in whom. And I would say that this is something that you would carry forward first, ideally, into individuals with this rare variant, and then into individuals with the biomarker. And I think that that's the hope. There's one area where, interestingly enough, there is some data looking at social behavior, using one of the same drugs we used to test whether receptor sensitivity has changed. And in rats, targeting that receptor actually leads to an increase in interaction. It's not clear whether that's specific to social behavior. It may actually just relate to anxiety-like behavior in those animals. And then there's a clinical trial that I think has wrapped up, but where results haven't been reported yet, studying a drug that targets that same receptor, done by the Shigani lab in collaboration with a number of other groups. Ideally, though, you'd want to know, does this relate to the biomarker, not just is this something that may work in the overall ASD population. So those are, broadly speaking, the two approaches, the precision medicine approach and the circuitry or maybe black box approach. And I'm actually hopeful about both. I think that we will see treatments that are effective in both approaches. And then I think that we will likely find some middle ground where we can identify biomarkers that tie some of these 1% populations together or help us understand what population is more likely to benefit from something like oxytocin. But ultimately, we need to tie that together with behavioral treatment. And I just briefly want to highlight both the potential of that and then the challenge of that. And this is really one of two examples where you have adequate sample size to implement such a treatment, and it's been tested in a randomized controlled fashion. And this is from the RUP group with Mike Amon as the lead author, where they treated the whole group of children with risperidone and gave some children a parent-delivered behavioral intervention and did not give that intervention, just gave a psychoeducational intervention to the other group. And they saw a significant improvement to adding on the behavioral intervention versus not adding it. Unfortunately, this didn't hold at 6 months. But in one of the challenges when you're doing a study like this, the group that received the behavioral intervention actually was prescribed less risperidone. because it didn't seem indicated to prescribe as much, or at least that's the idea. So this group has now shown that this same behavioral approach works in the absence of risperidone. But it illustrates the challenge of adding two treatments together, where you may have a treatment that already brings you to a behavioral floor or behavioral ceiling, depending on your approach. And it may be, say, that if we added a medication to early intensive behavioral intervention, we couldn't detect the added benefit of the medicine because we already have the effect of EIBI. Or in contrast, if you add a behavioral treatment to risperidone, you may not be able to detect the added benefit of the behavioral treatment at least 6 months out. What we'd prefer is something that's more like the story that's emerged with D-cycloserine that first came out of the rat literature and appears to facilitate extinction learning regardless, actually, of whether it's fear extinction or positive reinforcement extinction, and appears to do the same thing in studies of anxiety disorders where you use extinction learning as the primary treatment. And that's really exciting to think about. So if we had a medicine that could potentiate learning, this is an example where they give it once a week, right before they do the exposure and response prevention treatment for obsessive compulsive disorder, a study from Sabina Wilhelm. That's tremendous. And you see an increase in the rate of improvement early in the study. By the end of the study, there isn't a significant difference anymore. And that's maybe because the behavioral treatment has such an impact that if you deliver it long enough, you still see the benefit. But wouldn't it be amazing to have a treatment that would allow something like ESDM to work faster? Right now it's just hypothetical, but that's the sort of thing that we'd love to see over time. So I've gone through a lot of data. I've gone through a lot of concepts. Brief overview, I think we should acknowledge that all of our current treatments are not based on an understanding of pathophysiology, but based on an understanding of how we can address individual symptoms. Some of them are adapted to ASD. Some of them, frankly, are applied in ASD based on data outside of the ASD population. I would say we have tremendous promise for precision medicine. Please do come for the panel discussion following shortly after this, where that will be dissected in more detail. Some of those challenges will be talked about. Some more of the promise will be talked about. But I think that that's really going to lead us forward. But it's leading us forward in small groups at a time. Very exciting, but we need something that expands beyond that. I think we also are likely to make more progress using these circuitry-based approaches, stepping down from an understanding of how the symptoms relate to what may be happening in the brain, or something that may be happening in the brain of every mammal in relation to social function or in relation to repetitive behavior. I'm very hopeful about those approaches. But ultimately, I think that we need a way to bring these sorts of things together, and I think that biomarkers are ways to consolidate approaches and identify subgroups of individuals who will benefit, so that we can then tie what we know from that top-down approach to what we're learning from genetics and, frankly, what we're learning from immunology and learning from a number of other approaches as well. So thank you very much for your attention. I want to thank and highlight a number of folks who were acknowledged, who were involved at various levels, including the Vanderbilt Evidence-Based Practice Center, the Triad Translational Medicine Program, folks who were involved in that R-baclofen study, including Paul Wong, who really was the leader of that effort. And then acknowledge on the molecular side that this is the work of many, many hands, and I've highlighted pieces of it and highlighted those names as I went through. I particularly want to highlight those folks who sort of got me started. So if I hadn't wandered into the child psychiatry office those many years ago, I wouldn't have been inspired by people like Kathy Lord, Ed Cook, Bennett Leventhal, and then all of the folks who've continued to inspire me over time. And finally, funding sources, without which none of this would be possible. And that really comes down to the level of families that are pushing for government funding or that are directly giving to organizations like Autism Speaks or the Simons Foundation or the Autism Science Foundation and others. So thank you very much for your attention.